My name is Susan Willey, as I mentioned before, and I started this when I was the chair of the National Coordinating Committee on School Health and Safety, which is a group that brings together national organizations and federal agencies to talk about school health issues and policies. And so this is going to be at a different level. I'm not talking, it relates to schools, but we're talking more at federal level rather than in work that's in the schools directly. I have no financial relationships. So one of the things is, I think that school health often feels like we're a stepchild. We're a stepchild in the schools because they're about education and not health, and we're a stepchild in public health because they're about the public and not schools. And so there's often that feeling. So what I wanted to do in this presentation was talk about how school health is academic, is essential to public health. And two national projects that are going on in public health that have implications for school health. So some of you might be familiar with Healthy People 2020. It was launched on the beginning of 2020. It was launched last year in 2010. And just a little bit of history. Every 10 years, the Public Health Service, since 1979, has developed a set of objectives to guide the nation's work. And schools have always been included in that, although maybe not prominently. So some of the things from Healthy People 2020, a little big picture. The vision of it is that it's a society in which all people live long, healthy lives. The goals, higher quality of life, longer life, health equity, the physical environment, the social environment, and quality of life. They have included in Healthy People 2020 indicators of progress. Some of them relate to disparities. Some of them relate to determinants of health, especially social determinants, but others economic, academic, and that's where some of the school health ones come in. There's actually a presentation going on right now where the Department of Health and Human Services is introducing some of the refinement on the indicators of progress, and I can't be there because I'm here. So what they tried to do in developing the Healthy People 2020 objectives was integrate determinants of health with diseases and conditions rather than have them as separate kinds of objectives. And they organized them by topic areas to try to reflect common themes. There is no print version of Healthy People 2020. It is all online, and so you can search in different ways to try to find the objectives that might relate to the work that you're doing. But what I did was, with the help of Trina Anglin, who's at HRSA, which is a federal agency, and she's the coordinator for the National Coordinating Committee, we looked through all of the objectives in Healthy People 2020 to find school health related ones. And we found them in all of these places. So all of these are like chapter headings within the document. So we found them in 14 of the 42 topic areas. And what I'm going to do is I have asked Kathy Balsley, who was my study partner for my doctoral comps and who worked for many years in the Philadelphia Public Schools to help with handing out these handouts. And what I have done in the handouts is give you a list of all of these objectives that I found. And I didn't want to go through them all in the presentation. And what you will see there are the, if we go back to this coding, like AHDH, so the numbering on them sort of tells which section they're in, and then within that what number, and then you'll see that there are subheaders also within that. So if you want to look them up and see all of them, then you could know where to look when you get the handout. We look specifically for objectives that were ones that affected schools. There are additional objectives that relate to some school-age issues for children and youth, but that wouldn't be accomplished through schools. They might be through homes or through other settings. A couple of new sections in Healthy People 2020, for those of you that were familiar with Healthy People 2010, is that they have added a section devoted to adolescent health, and they have added a section devoted to early and middle childhood health. The early and middle childhood health group that worked on that, I was on that working group, and it was added very late in the process. But it has a lot of objectives in there related to school readiness, to academic performance, and that type of thing. In 2010, Healthy People 2010, there was an education and community-based section, which is where all the school health ones were, and they still have that section also. So there's still some of the school health section, particularly things related to health education in schools that you might find in the education and community-based section. So just to give you an example of how they are written, there is a goal, and this is an example of one of the ones from the educational and community-based programs, and the goal is to increase the quality, availability, and effectiveness of educational and community-based programs designed to prevent disease and injury, improve health, and enhance it. And then there is a little bit of an explanation in the Healthy People about what these kinds of programs are likely to do. So, a specific example of an objective in health education, and this came from EMC, so the early and middle childhood, is to increase the proportion of schools that require cumulative instruction in health education that meets the National Health Education Standards. There was never a reference before to the National Health Education Standards, so we tried in this to integrate across sectors. A safe learning environment, this was from the adolescent health one, to reduce the proportion of adolescents who've been offered or given an illegal drug on school property, so because it has the school in there. Then another one, increasing the proportion of students who are served under IDEA who graduate with a diploma. So it's not just increasing school graduation, which is also in there, but also looking very specifically at breaking that down. And you'll see that there's a 5.2. So 5.0 would be a more generic to graduation, and then 5.1, 5.2 are sub-goals under that. And another one, increasing the proportion of children who are ready for school in all five domains of healthy development. And if you go into the document, it'll actually see a description of the five domains of healthy development. So there's a lot of references in there that you can get to. Another handout, the one that's in color, the third one there, is a sort of a instruction manual for how to navigate the site of the Healthy People 2020. So if you are ready to go, if you want to go into that site, this is how to do it, where to find things, and that will help you. So, and that was developed by APHA's communication section. The second document I want to talk about, and this one I suspect a lot of people are less familiar with in the room, and this is the National Prevention Strategy, America's Plan for Better Health and Wellness, which was released this summer. It includes certain areas or strategies. There's a healthy and safe community environment section, clinical and community preventive services, and the whole idea of having empowered people. Elimination of health disparities. This came out of the Affordable Care Act. One of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, also known as the Health Care Reform Act, was that there had to be the establishment of a National Prevention Council, and they had to develop a national prevention strategy within a year. And I will say this is quite an accomplishment. They had, I think it was 17 federal agencies, many of them working at the secretary and undersecretary level, that they got within a year, and they got sign-off on all of those federal agencies. So if any of you have ever worked with federal agencies, this is amazing. It was chaired by the Surgeon General, and as I said, it was released in June. One of the things to me that is exciting about this is that all of these federal agencies made a commitment in this that they had a responsibility for the nation's health. So this included not only Health and Human Services, but the Department of Education, Department of Transportation, Department of Agriculture, Housing and Urban Development, Department of Defense, Environmental Protection Agency. I know there are others, Interior, so it was quite interesting. So the vision there was that working together to improve the health and quality of life for individuals, we can move the nation from a focus on sickness and disease to one based on prevention and wellness. So those of you that are in the room that have a commitment to prevention and health promotion, you know, this is pretty exciting, I think, to at least have the commitment in words. So they want to increase the number of Americans who are healthy at every stage of life. And they do make recommendations for early learning centers, which include daycare, preschool, whatever, for schools, for colleges and universities, so at each of those levels, as well as others, but that's one of the categories in which they make recommendations. So again, I'm going to give you some examples, but there are three handouts that in that clip, includes all of the ones that we found in throughout the document that relate to schools. So each time that they have an area, there's a fact, and so they have some key school health facts. So related to the environment, that 1 in 10 children under the age of 17 have asthma, and there are environmental factors that exacerbate asthma. So then they have the recommendations for this particular group. As I said, there are other recommendations also for others, but we just pulled out the school ones. And that is that they implement policies to promote healthy and safe environments. And so they have some examples there of air quality, mold, pesticides and leads, and tobacco-free. Another area in the clinical and community preventive services, again, a fact, 42,000 deaths per year prevented who receive childhood vaccines. And so things that schools can do include promote the use of evidence-based preventive services within their health services. So you can see they're broad, but this is the Department of Education has signed on to this as well as others. For empowered people, a fact, a person's decisions are influenced by how choices are presented. For example, if you present fruit in a more attractive way to school children, they found that it can more than double the amount of fruit that they purchase. And so something that schools can do is incorporate health education into coursework in various content areas. The elimination of the health disparities, fact, adolescents who grow up in neighborhoods that are concentrated with poverty are likely to be a victim of violence, use tobacco, alcohol, and other drugs, become obese, and engage in risky sexual behaviors. They're at higher risk for all of those, as was mentioned in the previous presentation. So some of the things that schools can do is offer preventive services for all children, especially those at risk. And so we've seen an example of preventive services. Another one is to develop and implement local strategies to reduce health, psychosocial, and environmental conditions that affect school attendance. So again, we want to have children graduate from school, and we need to make sure that there are not things that are preventing them from doing so. So the title of this whole presentation was Let's Be Advocates for School Health. Before I forget, I just want to mention that this session was sponsored by the School Health Education and Services section of APHA, and invite the people who are in the room. There is a social tonight starting at 6:30 in the Convention Center in 146A, sponsored by this section, and also the Public Health Education and Health Promotion section and the Physical Activity sections jointly. So since you're interested in schools, we invite you to that. So are there questions on this presentation? And then we'll open it up to just sort of broad questions and comments.
I know one of the things with the the prevention strategy is the funding. Do we have any look into how that seems to be going?
Well, of course, one of the there are some political factions that are trying to get rid of the Affordable Health Care Act completely. And then there are other groups that are trying to get rid of the prevention aspects of the Affordable Health Care Act. At this point, they're in there. I will say APHA's advocacy efforts there's a very strong push to advocate for keeping the prevention funds, and so far APHA and others have been successful in keeping that in. It's in the budget that has draft budget that's out there, but for the Senate. The House side, the committee couldn't agree on a markup. The House chair of the subcommittee put forth his own markup of the bill for the Health and Human Services budget, and he zeroed out the whole act. But that doesn't mean that's going to happen. Whether a budget gets passed at all is questionable right now. So when it comes to advocacy around these areas, I think keeping the word out that supporting prevention is important and keeping the prevention funding in there is important. We're never going to control health care costs if we just keep, you know, putting the Band-Aids on.
From an advocacy standpoint, do you think that aligning oneself with the National Prevention Strategy is more effective than aligning oneself with Healthy People 2020 in terms of kind of what's hot now?
Well, the National Prevention Strategy is an initiative of the Affordable Health Care Act and of this administration. So if people are supportive of this administration, then that might be a good thing to advocate using. Healthy People 2020 was initiated back in the 1979 in a Democratic administration. In the previous administration, there wasn't a lot of emphasis on the Healthy People 2010 because there was the Steps to a Healthier U.S., which was, so each administration likes to take credit for its own. But I will say that the Healthy People Initiative really drives things going on at the state levels. So if you're advocating within a state level at your state, and because the health departments have really glommed onto this, and that's how they develop level, I would definitely go with Healthy People 2020. Advocacy at the federal level, I think it depends on who you're talking to in terms of what messages you give. And I think some of the messages that some of the other speakers here have given, too, about effectiveness and the cost analysis, you know, of the what it costs school when kids are absent and that kind of thing. When you're doing advocacy, I think one of the important things is knowing who you're talking to, doing some homework on that person and where they're coming down, and then tailoring your message to that person and where their interests are. Okay, I'll open it up now. We've got a couple of minutes left for any broad questions on for any of the presenters or on advocacy for school health generally. No.
I have a question about increasing parental, getting parents more involved.
Mm-hmm. What I'm going to do is, because this is being recorded, I'm going to repeat the question and invite the presenters to come to the mic. So the question basically is, do any of the presenters have any suggestions for how to improve parental involvement? So.
I want to just say who you are so the recording.
I'm Myra. And there's a few things that we do. For one thing, we definitely have a strong, we have a parent recruiter kind of thing at the school site. So they're able to communicate with the parents at the students at the school. But other things that we do is just we really tailor our programs to be culturally and linguistically sensitive to these communities that we're working with. And so when we invite them to the school, we make sure that they feel welcome, that when they're coming to the university, it's not this kind of scary, black and white kind of just institution, but rather that we're welcoming, that we're talking in their language, if they need clarification with the different applications or whatever questions they may have in helping their students go to college. And so that and then makes them comfortable with the people who are working in the project, and so also makes them more involved. It helps getting the students more involved. The other thing that we do extra activities. Like, for instance, we hold an annual barbecue where it's actually at our project director's house. I know that's not always, you can't always facilitate that, but it really welcomes them and feels like they're part of a family kind of unit. And so that has really helped with their engagement in our program.
I think this comes back to the empowerment piece too. I just did a chapter on a book related to family engagement, and I think sometimes school people have a tendency to think of parents as part of a pathology, and the parents pick up on that, and there becomes this us-them kind of thing. So recognizing the parents as partners, and that they have assets, and that everybody wants what's best for the child, and how can we work together on that, and coming sort of with the mindset. There are a lot of parents who are very intimidated by school because of experiences they had as students, and helping them feel that they are a partner in that and not intimidated by the teachers and the education environment can help once you get them there.
This is Joan Bouchard from the Foundation for Healthy Kentucky. I can tell you what we're doing. I can tell you a little bit about Kentucky. We have site-based councils, which really do make a lot of decisions for schools. And they have to have two parents on the site-based council, in addition to two teachers and a principal. So you kind of see the dynamic there. There's three, two. But parents do have some power in the schools in Kentucky, and we're trying to encourage them to see that they have influence over the health environment, too. So that's one thing. And we work with the PTAs. Every year we do a school health institute in the summer. We have up to this point. And we offer free registration to the parents if they want to come. And every year we get a few more parents. We don't get them in droves like we were hoping. But going forward, our grant making is going to be done at the community level. And specifically, that's one of the reasons why, is because when we say, here, schools, this is your responsibility. we didn't get as much uptake as we would like. Now we're going to, and we'll see how this goes, stay tuned, but we're working with pediatricians. Maybe they'll be the leads on community health activities, which of course it's all going to be about children's health, so it's going to go back to the schools ultimately. But trying to work in the community and then say, well, maybe we can do something in the schools through the community bodies. So we're hoping that will work.
Any questions?
Absolutely. I brought a bunch of cards.
Another question?
Yeah.
This is a question kind of for Joan, but anyone can answer, which is, first of all, I'm heartened to feel kind of validated by your experience in the schools, kind of as sort of a similar, but I also, you know, there's kind of a sigh of, oh, sustainable change really is so hard. And so, you know, kind of that's really the question I ask, is that are there any kind of nuggets that have been culture changes that seem like they should be so simple and should not be based on whether there's funding or no funding? Kind of anything that came out of some of your star schools that could be helpful or modeled or replicated?
Okay, so I think the question is, are there examples of things that don't rely on funding, that came out of the star schools, that could really provide insight for sustainability for the long haul?
Right. Yeah. This was really Jeff's presentation. But there was a lot of value talking, sitting down face to face and talking to people. Yeah, there are some amazing things happening in Kentucky, because that's what I have to talk about. Some of them are kick-started with some funding, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know why that is. We have one county, Madison County. Now, it does have two universities, or it has a college, Berea College, and it has Eastern Kentucky University. But with it started out with a safety coalition at the public health department. It was the health educator, got a little bit of a safety grant. I don't know if you know Ruth Hawkins. And it has blossomed into a coordinated school health council, and all sorts of people are on board, and a local foods movement, and a complete streets program. So it really was this serendipitous coming together of a good mayor in a school district that was open, and some community people and public health people. And that's not the only one. There are several things going on in Kentucky that we're trying to nurture and watch and monitor and report on. It can happen, but it really does take the parents, the community, the school, sometimes the faith community. You know, it's the village. Takes a village, and it does. So be heartened. I am.
I think my foot's gone to sleep, but I will add something to that. Something that Susan mentioned also that is easily sustainable is presenting food better. This was not part of our presentation, but a colleague does this research. There was a lot of pushback from the cafeteria directors about including more fruits and vegetables because they said, we just throw it away, the kids won't eat it. But they actually did some research where they took pictures of the food trays when they went out and then when they came back. And they found that if you slice the oranges, something as simple as that, kids will eat the oranges. It has no effect slicing or unslicing the apples. So if you can take anything else back, slice the oranges, and kids will eat more fruit and get considerably more fruit intake. So that's something small that's sustainable.
Okay, well, if there are no other questions, I will thank you all for coming and ask you to be advocates for school health.